Big ol' Marcus.
Oh, dude.
Big ol' Marcus.
Right here.
Welcome back to the Native Ways Podcast. I'm your host, Richard Ellis.
I'm your co-host, Christian Miller.
And today, we're bringing a pretty cool episode to y'all. Something we've been looking forward to. We started talking with this guest probably about a month ago, kind of talking about the possibilities of actually having him on to do this episode and let Christian kind of lead us.
Yeah, so once again, if you're watching on YouTube, make sure you like, comment, subscribe. Also find us on all other platforms on TikTok, Instagram, and Facebook, Native Ways Podcast. But yeah, so this is Ryan. He's going to go ahead and kind of introduce himself for you so we can get to know him a little bit before we get into exactly what he's all about and kind of what he runs.
Well, I appreciate you guys inviting me. And man, I've never been offered lunch and a beer when I come to talk to somebody. So thank you guys.
Yes, sir.
It was a nice steak lunch, and man, I'm getting the high class treatment. So, no, but I love your show, and I really appreciate you guys having me on. So
we appreciate that. Yes, sir. Thank you for coming. So Ryan, you kind of want to tell them, you know, who you are, what you do, and you know, just a little bit about you, and then we'll kind of dive into really what you do.
Yeah. Well, my name is Ryan Murray. I live in Briggs, which is northeast Burnett County, about 15 miles south of Lampasas. I publish Texas Cash Magazine. It's a magazine that's been around for 30 years, but I've only been around for about a year and a half.
Okay.
I'm the third in line to keep the magazine going since 1994. So, the prior publisher, her name is Patricia Even. She's a good friend, and she did it for 20 years. She just retired last year, and I'm fortunate to keep it going.
Yes, sir. So, magazine's been around a while. It's gone through. Now you're the third to run it. What are some of your hobbies and stuff outside of Texas Cash? And then we'll dive into Texas Cash a bunch.
But yeah, well, I've got a couple little kids, a 4-year-old daughter and a 6-year-old boy, and so they keep me busy. I used to have hobbies.
Yes, sir.
No, but I still do. I love first of all, I love Texas. So that's the main thing with Texas Cash. I've got a reverence for our state that I think we all have, and I love history, legends, artifacts, Indians, cowboys, yes, all that stuff. So, and I love to hunt arrowheads and artifacts and try to get the story behind each artifact. Every artifact has a little bit of a story. It's almost like panning for gold. You might find a flake or some dust here and there with a story behind something, or maybe you might find a nugget or even a big vein of a story behind it. So that's what I love, and that's what I'm trying to bring to the magazine with it. And you know, I love putting pictures out there of the stuff that everybody finds, but the story behind the pictures is my favorite part.
Heck yeah.
And I like hunting and fishing too, all things outdoors, and so that's kind of the basis of what I like to do.
Cool. Yeah, I mean, I've only been a recent subscriber. Not that I haven't. I've always intended to subscribe to Texas Cash since I met Pat back in, I think it was 2021. But it was just one of those things, you know, I never really thought about it until I started talking to you, and then you sent us a bunch of stuff. We started talking.
I appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's crazy what just a little bit of word of mouth can do as far as, you know, like in that situation. I've always thought to subscribe to Texas Cash. Again, I've said that. But when we started talking, I was like, dang, I need to do that. Just putting that little bit of a thought in my head. So y'all listening, make sure you check out Texas Cash and go subscribe to it.
Yeah, I'd appreciate it. I'm trying to get it out there to the world.
Yeah. What is Texas Cash exactly?
Well, it started out in 94, as I said, by a taxidermist named Bob McWilliams. in San Angelo, and he's still around, and he's also a friend of mine, and he has my blessing to keep his baby going with the magazine. But he started in 94, and it was with his group, the Texas Amateur Archaeological Association, the TAAA, they called it. And he kind of pioneered he was instrumental in the early days of pay digs.
Okay.
And so this is his first issue right here. He did it, you know, newspaper like this. So this is his first issue. And he made it out of his taxidermy shop in San Angelo. He was cutting and pasting, literally cutting, pasting, really? Scissors and glue. Mm. And then he would make that newspaper there, and then it kind of evolved into a magazine. And Bob would he would feature all kinds of stuff that people sent in, and he would take people on digs and have parties and stuff. And he drew the ire of a lot of archaeological academic types, but he also brought a lot of people in who don't have that kind of background, just normal everyday Joes like us.
Yes, sir.
You know, mm-hmm. he brought people in like that. So, and Bob's great. I like that. I'm still friends with him. We chat on the phone every now and then, and I run into him a couple times a year. He and his wife Terry, they're real nice people, and I go to these events all the time. You know, about once a month, I go to an event and set up a booth there and try to sell subscriptions and stuff. And every time people are like, oh, yeah, 30 years ago, I knew Bob, and I would dig with him, and we would go out to Military Mountain or the, you know, just all over the place. Mm-hmm. And, so he's still got his legacy that's out there. And
yes,
it's 30 years later, you know, it's just as prominent as it was back then. So he did 10 years publishing the magazine, and then he passed it on to Pat. And so Pat and her husband, Harold, a.k.a. Buzz, they did the magazine for 20 years. And when she was ready to retire last year, then I took it over.
Awesome. So it's a... From my understanding, it's a quarterly published deal, right? So
yep.
There's four episodes per year, or four yep. publications per year.
Yeah, that's all I can afford.
Yeah,
if I get a few more subscribers, I'll do more. Man, I could fill 100 pages every time if I could, but I can't afford it.
Right,
and it's you know, printing a print magazine that you hold in your hand. That's there's costs incurred with that, so
right,
it ain't cheap. It's not very lucrative, but it sure is fun.
Yes, sir. Yeah, I can only imagine, and I'm sure we'll talk about some of the people and artifacts you've got to meet and see while doing it just in this past year and a half. And to me, you know, Texas Cash, it's always been a thing. Again, I've known about it since about 2021, but I've been digging since 2015, when I was 16 is when I started digging. And up until 2021, I'd never even heard of Texas Cash. So it's kind of one of those things, like, people that know it's there, but there's a lot of people that I don't think even know it's in existence. And to my knowledge, y'all are one of the only artifact magazines in the state of Texas.
Yeah, I'm as far as I know, it's the only one.
Yeah.
There's another artifact magazine called American Digger.
Yep.
They're out of Georgia, and I'm friends with them too. I know them, and I've gotten to meet Butch and Anita Holcomb. They're the publishers, and Debbie Schiffer Blades. They're big into metal detecting though. So most of the stuff that they do is historic artifacts and like Civil War stuff, and not prehistoric. They do have some prehistoric stuff, but as far as I know, we're about the only two. Other than archaeological journals,
yeah,
which are more like academic, we're the two kind of layman's magazines.
Yes, sir.
Ragtag rags.
So, what does it look like I guess your editing process, and how do you put in the magazine together?
Well, my fancy office is in my laundry room, so I have about maybe 3 foot of desk space in there with my computer, and at any given time I've got dogs at my feet or kids crawling on my back and yelling and screaming, and the laundry going behind me. So it's that's how I work on the magazine. But I put it together with a program called Adobe InDesign, and then I put it into a PDF form, get it all polished up as best as I can, and then I send the PDF to a print shop in San Antonio.
Okay.
And then they print at a minimum 500 copies. So sometimes I do 500, sometimes I do 1,000. And then I mail them out to all over Texas, and I think I'm up to 26 other states.
Really?
And one guy in Saskatchewan. So that's shout cool. out to Dean Cook, my only Canadian subscriber up in Saskatchewan there.
That's cool.
But I mail it all over, and that's kind of how the process works. And
yeah, you're just a one guy show though when it comes to all the editing and putting it together.
Yeah, I'm the editor, publisher, sometimes a photographer, the janitor,
right?
But my wife Jessica, she's the accountant. I'm so bad at math that I can't even count how many times I failed math. That's how bad it is. I don't have the math brain. I've got the more of a writing brain, I guess. But luckily, I have Jessica, and she helps me with tax stuff and keeping my ledger straight and all that stuff.
So when we're talking about the writing aspect of it, because I mean, there's a lot of literature just within one publication on its own. Where are you? Are you handwriting this entire deal, or is it a lot of it? I'm sure some of it's storytelling.
Yeah, a lot of it is. I get people to send me stuff, and then I ask them to write down their thoughts and all whatever information they want to include with along with pictures, and then I kind of put it into the right size that it needs to be to fit on the page.
Yes, sir.
Speaking of that, that's an open invitation for anybody to send me stuff. I might have to sit on it for a while because due to printing and space constraints, but I've got probably 30 draft stories going really? Right now, and sometimes it's just two sentences, or other times it's 10 pages long. And then once it's ready, then I get it together and package it.
Okay.
And a lot of times I'll just sit on something for a long time. And when I'm reading things, I'll go back to that just kind of a brainstorming file and just be like, oh, I need to write this down. And I'll run over to the laundry room to my computer and, type something out. Like, don't forget to include this on whatever story.
Mm-hmm. That's how we are. We've got a notes tab that we have shared to each other. And like just today we added two things to it. We're always,
Yeah, it never ends.
Yeah.
It's constant.
You're always thinking of
constant
something.
Adding your ideas into something like that is essential. Otherwise, at least for me, it just floats away eventually if you don't write it down.
If I don't write it down, I tend to just forget about it because my mind's always going all the time. I'm always thinking about something. It's kind of one of those things.
We're terrible about it because we're always thinking, between where we're hunting, what we're hunting, when we're hunting it, when we're digging, where we're digging, what we're digging.
So many things going on in your brain, huh? Right.
What we got to cook our wives for dinner because our wives don't cook.
Probably didn't want to put that on there.
That was a joke. Lauren cooks every now and then.
Well, your steak lunch was really good, so I got to give you props for I'll vouch for your cooking skills.
I appreciate it.
Steak ranchero.
Yeah, that's the first time I made that, so not upset about it. So that being said, we kind of know the ends to Texas Cash now. Where can people find the magazine? Do you have social medias? I think you just handle all the magazine itself, right?
Yeah. So, I, the only social media I do is Instagram. I never was on social media that much. There's a Facebook page that Pat, the prior publisher, she maintains it. It's called Texas Cash Voice. And that's just her thing. You know, she does all that. And so if anybody's trying to get a hold of me, I don't see if somebody sends her a message on Facebook, I don't get it unless she specifically forwards it to me. And I know that's not a great marketing strategy. I need to get on Facebook, but I just never have. And I'm 46 years old, and at this point, I'm like, you know, every time I start to get on it, I can picture Mark Zuckerberg's beady little eyes laughing at me. I knew I'd get you one of these days. I just like, man, and I just don't do it. And I had one bad experience about a year ago with Facebook, where I let somebody who I trusted look at a draft article that I had been spending 3 or 4 months working on. And it's one of the best things I had ever written. And he put it out on Facebook without asking me, and
really,
and tried to attribute it to himself. And I didn't know about it. And I started getting messages from people. Hey, I saw your thing on Facebook. I'm like, what?
Mm.
And so, you know, the only time I get on Facebook is to get in a fight with a stranger. So right. I've never gotten around to it. And I know I need to get on the other stuff too, but that's almost one of those things. If I ever can afford it, I'm just going to
have somebody handle it.
Yeah. I'm not good at it.
Yeah. I mean, I'd say we're kind of the same. Like, I've had Facebook, Instagram, all that stuff for a long time, but until this is the only thing we're really even active on is on our podcast channel or pages. Mm-hmm. My personal page, I might post once a week or something. And mm-hmm. like you said, used to, it was nothing but arguing with people and whatever. Now I don't even really look at my timeline because it's so frustrating seeing everybody arguing, especially right now with the election just finished up.
Yeah.
Oh,
everybody's got their opinions.
Yeah. It's like, dude, I've got better things to do than see y'all bicker about, you know, what you think happened.
Yeah. And we all have our opinions, but I try to keep that out of the magazine.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's just, I'm running it as a business. Mm-hmm. And I check the politics out if I can.
Yeah.
You know, I have my own feelings about everything, but it's not something that I feel the need to
share on there.
To share on that format.
Absolutely.
You know? Right.
That's the same way we viewed it. And that's how we run our pages too. You know, the whole goal with what we're doing is we're wanting to bring together, you know, the hobby communities that we're a part of: hunting, fishing, digging, all that. We want a place everybody can come share their experiences. Kind of like Texas Cash. Like, that is literally a open voice for, you know, diggers, artifact collectors. We're kind of wanting to do the same thing through this podcast, through our pages and stuff. Very similar thought
yeah.
process.
Well, you're doing a good job, and that's people come to that stuff to kind of get away from the bickering, I
yeah.
think.
So yeah.
It's we get enough of the bickering.
Yeah.
Everywhere else.
So that being said, you were talking about, you know, kind of going through and people sending you information draft type stuff for future articles. What is your criteria? Like, what if somebody has something, they're like, oh, maybe I want to send this to Ryan. What do they need to do? What does it need? What is the guidelines?
Nothing illegal. I can't. that's the main thing.
Yeah.
I can't publish anything that has come about through ill-gotten,
poached.
You know, breaking the law.
Yeah.
That's kind of where I draw the line. Or so desecrating a human grave.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, but there's so much interesting stuff from the human graves that I know. I love publishing all this stuff, but there's so much that I can't really.
Yeah.
You know, because like, it's disrespectful.
Yeah, I agree. We kind of talked about that prior to starting the episode, because a few episodes back we had Ren on, and Ren illustrates archaeological sites that included graves. And, you know, to me, there's, I don't really know where you draw the line, because to me, if you're a private digger, it's unacceptable. I would never touch one. I don't think Christian would ever touch one. But I know there's a lot of people that are like, oh, yeah, you know, let me in that.
Oh, yeah.
That's where the good stuff's at. Well,
sure.
It brings a bad rep on digging, honestly. I kind of think if you're going to do that, leave it to the archaeologists. Not that that's probably an unpopular opinion for, you know, recreational diggers. But, hey, sorry, that's my opinion.
Yeah, you know, and I've been on a pay dig before, and we started hitting teeth and finger bones in the screen.
Mm.
And it became quickly apparent that these were human remains. And,
mm-hmm.
And that was, man, without going into too much about it, it was a mass grave of men, women, and children.
Mm.
And the points we were finding there were Enzer. So it was probably somewhere around 2000 years ago, something happened, and there were, I think they thought there was maybe 70 bodies just buried in there. And,
really?
And when I found a few finger bones and some teeth on the screen, and I just went over and put them back in the dirt and kind of patted the dirt and said a little prayer, said, I'm sorry. Sorry. Mm-hmm. You know, without getting too into it, there's a little bit of bad juju, I think,
yeah,
with disturbing a grave. But I also hear stories, you know, and see pictures. A neighbor of mine sent me a picture of just a G10 Marshall Point, and he said that he was under a tree root digging, you know, over his head, and it was inside a skull. In the mouth, like somebody, probably they had set it in the mouth. Not that it was.
Yeah, it wasn't penetrated.
Yeah.
Penetrated. It was probably somebody buried with that on their tongue or something. But it was just, I saw a picture of it, and he was a fence jumper, you know. So I was like, God, that would be a great picture for the magazine, but I'm not gonna go.
Can't
there.
Do it. Yeah, mm-hmm. I don't blame you. And like I said, I disagree with touching grave sites myself personally. If it's going to be messed with, I don't guess there's really much difference in an archaeologist digging it up versus regular everyday guy, but it morally it's the same thing. But there's information they can gain from it more than I can gain from it. And like you said, I don't want to deal with whatever may come out of disturbing it. Some people may laugh at us for that, whatever. I don't care. I'm not going to do it. And I don't support it. I don't promote it. I don't care if people do it.
Yeah.
Ain't doing it. So I think that's definitely a good line to have, you know, no fence jumping, no gravesite stuff. I could say if it was publications, and that's kind of like with Wren, like all the stuff she documents or illustrates is stuff that's been documented.
Yeah. And she's not disturbing anything by making a picture of it.
Yeah, exactly.
She's a great artist too, by the way. I like her a lot. I've met her in Temple, and
very,
she's
very,
awesome.
Very kind mm-hmm. woman.
And there's nothing that she is doing that is disturbing anybody. She's just making art.
Absolutely. I agree with that 1,000%. And like I said, in her situation, those sites, they've been documented. You know, there's stories behind what she's doing. So the proper measures have been taken to recover those pieces and then her to share that with us. And I think that's okay. But as far as just going through, digging up graves, anyway, we'll get out of that rabbit hole. We'll just,
One more thing, though. I was talking to this guy recently, and he found, well, he claims he found, and I believe him, a sitting full skeleton in a grave with a metate, an upside-down metate over its head, and the skeleton was surrounded by seven severed skeleton heads.
Really?
Yeah. And so the archaeologists who were around there, you know, he said something like, you know, it was not just somebody willy nilly digging. It was an excavation, and all they said was, yeah, those seven people had a bad day.
Yeah, I guess so.
I hear stories like that all the time.
Yeah.
You know, and mummies found in caves.
Really?
Oh yeah. I've had a few pictures sent to me, and maybe there might be a place to do a story about that, but right now I don't want to go there with human.
I definitely don't
want to keep the respect, because respecting Indians and ancient people is real important to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of people accuse diggers of, oh, well, you're just
looters,
looting the past. But I don't know anybody who digs that doesn't have, you know, a special appreciation for the people that they're recovering their artifacts of.
I'd say a particular group of people may not, but that's a whole separate deal.
Yeah.
But yeah, I agree. I mean, everybody that does, especially as a hobby, if you're a hobbyist doing this, archaeologist doing this, you have a passion for the people, for the history, and for the pieces, and it doesn't matter what your motive is. You appreciate this stuff.
Yeah.
And appreciate the people. And talking about severed heads and Matatis, that Matati right there almost hit me on the head when I found it.
Is that right?
Yeah.
It fall down on you?
Just about. It was the last day me and my dad had dug that camp. And we hadn't found any Matatis in there. A bunch of grindstones, and we barely touched this place before it sold. Maybe dug 1-2% of this camp. And I was actually kind of done digging for the day, and I'm just sitting there, and Dad's digging along. And I was like, you know what? I'm gonna lip my hole real quick, dig a little further and lip my hole off and just, you know, kind of backfill this. And I had kind of tunneled under it pretty good, and I seen the edge. If you actually look at it, there's a Z on top of it where my pick drug across it. But I seen the edge of it, and I was like, man, that is extremely smooth. And I pointed at my dad. I said, hey, does this look like a Matati to you? I think I think where I hit it's actually on this side.
Oh, yeah, I see it.
I said, does that look like maybe it might be a Matati? He was like, yeah, it looks awful like it. Well, the bowl was stuck up in the ceiling where I had tunneled under it. So I stuck my head under, and I looked at the bottom side of it, and it was totally flat on the bottom. And I was like, And about the time I pulled my head out, it went boom and just fell right in front of me, right where my head was at.
Bowl, yeah, that'd hurt you.
Yeah, it would.
So, that'd leave a lump.
Yeah, maybe Matatis have something to do with severed heads.
Well, I know at least in a lot of the caves out in, you know, the Pecos area and Big Bend, they would cover the skeletons with an upside down one. So
really?
If you're in a cave, you find an upside down Matati, chances are you might find a skeleton underneath it.
Huh. That's pretty wild.
I've heard that a lot. I've never actually done that. I've never even been able to dig out there in that area, but I hear a lot of people who have, and they've told me that.
Yes, sir. Christian, you want to kind of get into, we've kind of covered what got you into Texas Cache, but maybe kind of lead them into what got them into artifacts.
Yeah. I mean, so I know that we kind of briefly spoke before this about some things that you've come across and stuff like that. So if you want to kind of recap that for us so everybody can hear it.
I was in Cub Scouts when I was a kid, and we would go out to the lakes, and looking back, I think probably the scout leader was salting some arrowheads, but we thought it was real.
Yes, sir.
And I still have a bunch of those. And going out with my grandpa to Lake Texoma, we would find pottery and stuff, and that kind of got me into it. My other grandfather, he was a uranium miner in Monument Valley, Arizona, Kayenta area. And so he had a big collection of artifacts and an Anasazi bowl that, you know, sat on our shelf for 50 years. But I was the only one who really was interested, and so I inherited that stuff, and I still have it. And I have his case and everything. That kind of got me started as a kid in the hobby. And I always liked fossils and it's kind of a rock hound. But then about 12 or 13 years ago, my folks bought the farm, literally, not figuratively. They're still alive. But they bought some land out in Briggs, which is where I live now. At the time, I was working in a warehouse in Austin. But I would go out there and hunt arrowheads and look for stuff out there. And one day I stumbled on to a bone in Rocky Creek, and it turned out to be the The Complete Skeleton of a Bison. That's this book here. And it's Rocky Creek is where it was, which is a tributary of the Lampasas River before it gets into, before it runs into Stillhouse Hollow Lake. Mm-hmm. And so we kind of nicknamed this this bison skeleton Rocky. And gosh, it would take me 20 minutes to tell the whole story, but
I would love to hear it.
But I was down there fishing in the creek one time, and this is right under the highway. If you're driving on the highway and you look down, it's right there. You know, it's a million cars go by there every day. and not even knowing what's down there. But I was in the creek bed. It's an ugly little fishing hole, but there's decent largemouth and hybrid bass down mm-hmm. there. And so I was down there one day just by myself. My wife and I were newlyweds. We didn't have kids yet, and so every now and then I'd go down there after work and just kind of putz around and found a bone sticking out of the bank, and it was maybe like the size of a piece of chalk. You know, it was tiny, but I knew I could tell it was a bone. And so I went up back up to the house and got a milk crate and stood on it and a little onion rooting trowel and tried to dig the bone out. And then, you know, and it was hard caliche. It wasn't easy to dig out. And I'm reaching up, you know, 8 feet, you know, as high as I can, trying to get it. And the dirt's coming down on my face and ants are biting me and stuff, you know. But I pulled out a leg bone, I don't know which bone it was. But then I noticed behind it, oh, there's another one in there. So I dug a little bit more, and then I came back a week later, dug a little bit more. Oh, there's more bones in here. And kept coming back to it, just poking the dirt away just a little bit at a time. And turns out it was a whole entire buffalo skeleton in there. From one end to the other was about 8 feet. Mm. You know, from the caudal tail bones to the time when I finally found the horn core sticking out. I thought it was a root at first, but then I was like, oh, okay, here's the head. We were talking earlier that those bones were really brittle and they were kind of falling apart. I mean, they had the consistency of like a cracker or a Cheeto.
Yeah.
You could snap them like that. You could flick them and they would break.
Yeah.
And so eventually, once I figured out the whole entire animal was in there, I was like, I was down there with my buddy and we had constructed a scaffold. My friend Jeff and I were, and we would just hang off there drinking beer, poking at it. And he finally goes, dude, let's stop doing this because we're going to destroy this thing. Let's cover it up and get somebody, see if somebody else can come and do this properly. And I was like, yeah, you know, you're right. And so we covered it up. And in the meantime, I started doing research. And that's when I found help there online. And I asked around everybody I could think of. I went to Texas Tech back in the 90s, and I tracked down some of my old professors and was like, hey, can you help me, you know, figure out what to do? And when I was out at Tech, there's a town just east of Lubbock called Crosbyton. Mm-hmm. And at the time, there was this eccentric guy who had a museum there. And in his museum, he had an entire mastodon skeleton.
Really?
And he also had like a chupacabra, you know, and he was a really interesting guy. I really like him. He's since passed away. But at the time, I remember, you know, we would go camping out at this place called White River Lake, and we'd pass through Crosbyton on the way, and I would always look at it like, oh God, that guy's got a mastodon skeleton just in his window. It's so cool. You know, and he was probably an ex-hippie, I would guess. Yeah. You know, big big beard and long white hair. And his name's Joe Taylor. And so I tracked him down. And he said, I said, you probably don't remember me, but I used to come into your place. And he immediately was very supportive. And he sent me a bunch of diagrams to go by and told me exactly how to dig this thing out. And he sent me stuff called PVA crystals. It's, they're, you know, it's maybe like the size of a grain of rice, each crystal is, and it's clear plastic crystals. And then when you mix it with acetone, it makes a clear glue that you drip down into the bones and it'll harden those bones. And so, that way, when we were pulling them out, we would drip that stuff in there, and it would harden the bones, and they weren't so fragile. And the cool thing about that also is, if you want to remove that glue, you just do straight acetone, and it dissolves it, and it returns it back to the original condition. So it doesn't do any damage, doesn't alter anything. It just hardens the bones, so you can get them out of the ground.
Transport it.
Yeah. So he was real instrumental in helping me do that. And in the meantime, I found David Callum, who he runs a group called Texas Borderland Archaeology. And so what he does is he'll come out and he's an avocational archaeologist. He doesn't have any formal training or academic stuff, but he's a very prolific site recorder. And he helped us do it properly, and he brought a guy named Bruce Turner out and some other people. And we just had, over two weekends, we had a party, you know, a four-day party, basically just digging this thing out and,
yes, sir,
and documenting it. And so I had a diagram, and anytime we would pull a bone out, we would bag it and tag it, and then I would write down where exactly on the diagram it came from. And so that was, you know, so much more preferable to me than just digging it willy-nilly and digging it out. And so eventually we put it back together and gave it to a museum in Marble Falls.
Very cool.
And so that kind of got my foot in the door with not only people like David, who are non-academic archaeologists, but actual archaeology. Yeah, that's kind of just where I started meeting people left and right, and just kind of jumped into the digging world.
Gotcha. So before we kind of progress past Rocky, is he on display for people to see him?
Yeah, it's the museum is called the Falls on the Colorado Museum in okay. Marble Falls. It's an old school building, and a gentleman who's unfortunately has since passed, he built a beautiful display case out of wood and glass, and so it's in there. And they were able to raise some funds in the town. They had a fundraising drive, and they were able to pay a fossil bone restoration expert to come and kind of put it back together, and so now it's on display. And they tried to keep it, you know, as close to the as close to what it looked like as possible when it was still in the ground.
Okay.
At first they tried to stand it up, but there was no way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then, so my next question before we move on from that, what does the excavation process look like in an archaeological setting like that?
This was kind of different because it was on a sheer bank. It was vertical, you know, and so it's not the same as if you were just on flat ground digging down. We were hanging off on a scaffold, you know, scratching away at it. And so that was more of a salvage job. And so what we would do is we had a quarter-inch mesh screen up on the top of the hill, and so we would fill the buckets up with the fill dirt that we were pulling out of the interior cavity of the animal's chest and belly area. And then we'd put it in the buckets and then hand the buckets up to somebody else, and then they would screen it. And that's where we found four or five pieces of broken flint, which at the time, you know, I would just find a little, you know, smaller than a pea, piece of flint, but you could tell, you know, it was flint, and it looked out of place. And then we bagged it, and then you number it, and then when David took it home, he put them all back together, and you could tell it was a Pardinale's, or rather a Perdis point inside it. So,
very cool.
So we don't really know the whole story. I think maybe it might have just washed into that position. But David is convinced that it was a kill.
Yeah.
So mm-hmm. I don't know. So that they also carbon dated it to about 700 years old too. So that was, that fit the time of a Perdis arrowhead.
Yes, sir. Yeah. I mean, that's right in there. That's cool. So not for sure that was the means of how it died, but
yeah, no way to really know.
You don't think, mate, or you think you're a little more skeptical on it, but David does think that is probably the cause of death. Is that Perdis?
Uh-huh.
That's way cool. Way cool.
Yeah. So now that we kind of gotten through some of your own personal sites and discoveries and stuff, is there anything in particular that you could see in any of the issues that you've had to document that would be more memorable or anything kind of interesting?
Gosh, man, I've only been doing this for a year, but I've been privy to so much cool stuff that, and not just artifacts, but stories too. We were just looking at this. I just wrote this story. I've been working on it for several months, but there's a collector that lives up the road from me named Bill Arnold. He's pretty famous in the community. He's a dealer, an artifact dealer. But I was talking to him on the phone, and he just casually mentions the Spanish ruins in Lampasas. With graves from the 1700s, and I'm like, what are you talking about? He said, oh yeah, you hadn't heard about that? And so I started looking into it, and man, it was the rabbit hole of all rabbit holes. Dude. Sorry. So that's another thing that takes forever to tell the story, but I'll try to go as quickly as I can. So the story is, back in the 1750s, when Texas was New Spain, the Spanish were moving eastward from what's now Mexico, and into Comanche territory, or rather Apache territory, and the French were moving from the east to the west, and the Comanche were moving from north to south, and they were all pushing the Apache. And the Apache, really, the path of least resistance for them was into New Spain, and they kind of strung the Spanish along with promises of going to the missions, but they never really had any intention of doing that. They pretty much tricked the friars and the clergy, and so in what is now Menard, there's the famous San Saba mission and Presidio. And so that place, it was a mission for a few years. And then one day in March of 1750, either 1756 or 1758, I can't remember, but 2,000 Comanches and a few other associated tribes with them came to the mission waving a white flag, and all the soldiers told the Padres, don't go out there. And the Padres said, no, we need to earn their trust. But that was their fatal mistake. And they just got annihilated. At that point, the Indians had French guns. And so they just massacred everybody there, except for one guy that got out and was able to tell the story. And so that's well documented, that incident. And but what's not so well documented is there was an attempted sister mission started by the same people. the same. It was a wealthy mining guy. He was interested in having an Indian workforce for silver mines in the area. And so the way to do that was to get the Apaches into the missions and, you know, Christianize them and then put them to work in the mines.
Wow.
And so his cousin was one of the friars that was, he was a monk, and he was killed in that attack in Menard. But so at the same time, those same two people, they were trying to establish a mission in Rumley, which is just east of Lampasas, about 7 miles, on Lucy Creek. It's called Lucy Creek now. At the time, it was called DeLucia Creek in Spanish, but then that name changed to Lucy Creek. And so they started a mission there in the 1750s, and they didn't get very far in the construction. They built stone walls, and it was a mission and ranching complex with a fort about 7 miles away. They would, at that point, the Spanish had learned to separate the church and the fort by some distance because, well, there's lots of reasons, but one of the main ones was Indians wouldn't come into the missions if there were a bunch of soldiers around. And the soldiers were mainly conscripted criminals, and they didn't, and the Padres didn't want the criminals corrupting the Indians. So they kept them at a distance, you know? The Comanche just kept attacking them at this spot in Rumley, which is Lampasas County. I don't remember if I mentioned that, but, they abandoned it. You know, they gave up. And then when the mission in Menard was destroyed, they just left, you know. And so what they left behind in Lampasas County was just the stone walls and I think some wooden palisades, trees that they had just made into a fort. That's long gone, but the stones are still there.
Really?
Yeah. And so one of the things they did at this mission site was it was built around a geographical feature called Arroyo Caballo, which is Spanish for horse ditch or horse gully. And you can drive right over it on the road. You'd never know what you're looking at. That's why I was so fascinated. Like when Bill talked about that, I was just like, dude, that's the craziest story. And so, and it just gets crazier from there. So, after the Indians attacked and they decided to just leave that behind, there was a guy in the Spanish ranks. He was from Philadelphia, and his name was Thomas Cox, and he was a mercenary. He was from Pennsylvania, so he was a colonial American, but he was in the Spanish army in the 1750s when he was like 17 years old or something. And so one of his jobs was catching horses in that Arroyo Caballo. What they would do is they would bait horses into that ditch and then corral them at the downstream. They had nowhere else to go. Once they entered that ditch, they were trapped. So they abandoned the mission in the 1750s, and he ends up almost 30 years later in the Revolutionary War back home in Pennsylvania. And he's in the army. He was an enlisted officer in the Continental Army with George Washington's army, and he was in several battles, and he ended up convincing his superiors. He said, "Hey, we need more mounted men. We need horses." And he goes, "I know where to get as many horses as we need." And he was able to convince them to dispatch himself and five nephews back down there. And so they came, they rode from Philadelphia down to Lampasas and back to this spot, right, where the mission was. And they spent 40 something days rebuilding the corral, because it had been crumbling for 28 or 29 years and just kind of you know, you don't really know exactly what the Indians were doing there. They might have still been there doing, they probably were catching horses there.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's Comanche and Apache who are by all accounts, the finest horsemen.
Yeah.
On the continent, I think. But, so anyway, Thomas Cox goes back there with his nephews and they rebuild the corral. And, on their first trip, it took them, I think, like 5 months or something. It was just a long trip. And they came down and once they finally had the corral ready, they baited it with grain and salt. And the first night, a stallion led 40 horses in there.
Really?
Yeah. And so then they broke them. And then it just repeated the process until they had 373 horses in this corral.
There you go.
And they braided rawhide ropes together, and each man led, or not each man, but each line of horses was 100 horses long.
Jeez.
and they took them all the way back to Philadelphia that way.
Holy cow.
373 horses, and brought them to the army. And so, and this, the reason we know all this is because it was documented in Thomas Cox's journal.
Hmm.
And so it's not like a big story. Not too many people know about this.
Yeah.
And the more I'm reading about this, the more I'm just like, God, this is such a cool story. And and I spent months just trying to research as much as I could and writing it. But so anyway, they come back to Philadelphia, and his superiors were so pleased that they immediately sent him right back.
Really?
Yeah. And he could go get more.
Yeah. That kind of sucks for him, I guess.
Yeah.
But
became rich. He and his nephews became rich men because they had all these political and business connections.
Yes, sir.
With famous people. And one of them was Bernardo Galvez, who Galveston, the town, is named after.
Hmm.
He was a Spanish-born governor of Louisiana at that time, and he hated the British, and so he was eager to help Thomas Cox take more horses to fight the British. And so he charged 25 cents a head per horse, and then when Cox brought him back to Philadelphia, the U.S. Army gave him $35 a head. So they just became rich.
Dang.
So they came back, and there was 873 horses that they brought back for the Revolution from Land Passes.
Wow.
That's crazy to think how many horses were there.
Yeah.
It's crazy to think. That's just right down the road from here. That's like 10 miles.
It's wild. And there were so many feral horses out there that they would say that if the herds would get into a big stampede, they would all join into one big stampede, and there'd be 10,000 horses in a stampede.
Holy cow.
You could hear it from like 10 miles away or something. Mm-hmm.
That's crazy.
Because there's no highway noise.
That's crazy. Yeah.
But yeah, that was just one of those rabbit hole stories that I just kept going down, and I was like, I had to spread it out over two magazines because it was such a cool story. So that was the most recent one I did, but, yeah, I could go on and on about that.
I'd love to hear more. I mean, between, you know, historical sites like that, you know, Indian sites, artifacts that you've got to document. I mean, you get to publish some of the finest artifacts in the state of Texas for sure.
Yeah, people send me stuff, and it's so cool. Next story I'm working on is a Clovis that was made out of mammoth tusk ivory.
Really?
Yeah.
Found in Texas?
Uh-huh.
Wow.
Yeah. And it's right now, the guy who found it, he has loaned it to the Coastal Museum of the Coastal Plains in Victoria. And so I'm working on that. And I know a guy, I don't know him, I've been in contact with a guy who tried to recreate it. He's a napper. And I think he lives in Oregon. And he tried to recreate it. So he wrote up all this stuff about it. And, that's going to be my next story, but yeah, there's just so much interesting stuff. The first story I ever did, you guys know Mike Boutwell?
Yeah. Was it the drill?
Yeah.
Oh boy.
Yeah. He found a, he lives in Leander, but he's that guy. I think he you know, his slogan is, if I'm not working, I'm digging.
Yeah, he's...
And I've gotten to go over to his house and shout out to Mike, by the way.
Yeah, he's a great dude.
And yeah, he's been real cool sharing his collections. But the first story I ever wrote was about that drill. What he found was a drill stuck inside a deer femur. And it's still in there. He's never taken it out or anything. But, you know, I think I wrote 4 or 5 pages just about that, going and you know, researching as much as I could. But what we think it is was they were trying to get the marrow out.
Yeah.
And, you know, I even broke a fresh deer bone in a similar way to try to
replicate
it. Yeah, to try to replicate it. And that was another rabbit hole. Like, I found all this stuff. Like caves in Israel where they found deer legs where they would preserve, they could preserve a deer leg. They could preserve the marrow for up to 5 weeks.
Really?
In caves. And, there, you know, he found that on Salado Creek here in Williamson County. And, so, you know, there's caves in Williamson County. Oh, they're yeah, probably doing the same thing.
There's a lot of them. Yeah, I don't doubt it. And so, like, I was going to tell you about it earlier when we were talking about how brittle the buffalo bone was. That last site my dad and I hand dug, we found 2 antler handles, knife handles,
oh, yeah?
in association with Castorvilles. And,
oh, yeah, cool.
I found one and he found one. The one I found is broken in half. And like you were saying, really brittle. It's broke basically right in the middle, but the antler's totally hollowed out, and then the burr of the antler is rounded out, real smooth, polished. But the one my dad found was whole. Now, when he pulled it, when we extracted it, it was brittle, and it broke, but it was there enough that we could piece it back together, and you know, it's still a whole piece. But you can see where they cut the antler and then cut across it to open the antler. And then they hollowed it out, and then the end of that antler, the burr end of that antler, is smoothed out too. Really, really cool pieces. But like you were saying, I'm sure some of that marrow is gone just over time, but mm-hmm. they started, you know, they had to core it out some just to haft
yeah.
whatever they had in it.
Yeah, that stuff, it's hard to find that kind of stuff in our area here because yeah. it just deteriorates and mm-hmm. turns to dust.
Yeah, when we found those 2 pieces, we were pumped. I found one day, and then the next day he found one, and they were both in association with some really nice Castorvilles. I found a broke Castorville square-eared that would have been over 5 inches. I mean, probably a foot and a half from where I found that handle. And then he found 2 square-eared Castorvilles with his within a foot of that handle.
Wow.
He found. Just 2 awesome days of digging.
Huh.
But not, yeah, Michael's handle, or I don't know if it's a handle, whatever it was, that is a crazy piece. And you always see people talking about finding points stuck in bone or whatever. That drill is literally stuck in bone. And
yeah, it's still got the dirt inside there. And he even took it to a friend of his that was in the dental industry, and they x-rayed it.
That's cool.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, you could see that drill goes all the way into that femur.
Mm-hmm. That's a cool way to do it, because I know that he's posted on his TikTok and on his Instagram stuff saying, you know, should I remove it? Should I not? And I think he's pretty adamant about not removing
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
So leave that's a cool there. Way to kind of give you an idea of what it actually was.
Yeah, you can see it with the x-ray
wow.
there.
Wow. That's awesome.
That was the first story I wrote. And then the other one that I did earlier this year was obsidian, a story about obsidian, which, long distance obsidian.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that really interesting. I've got a couple, I've actually got them in my truck. I forgot to bring them in, but I have 2 flakes. Actually, you know what? I think they're over here. But,
go ahead.
Yeah, let me grab them. I found a couple flakes. Yeah, here they are. I mean, they're not much bigger than your fingernail, you know? But I found this in Williamson County in Hutto.
Yeah.
At a dig site. And you can take a piece of obsidian like this and send it off to a lab in Missouri, at the University of Missouri. and they run it through a machine called an XRF spectrometer, I think that's it. Looks kind of like a record table, and they bombard it with an X-ray, and then they can see different wavelengths that come off of it, and pinpoint the exact volcanic formation that it came from. Mm-hmm.
I've wondered how they did that. I know.
Yeah, it's wild that they can do that. And so I found this in Hutto, just north of Austin, but it traced to Idaho.
Mm-hmm.
So it came from like, and I did the distance before. I think it's like 1,200 miles or something. Yeah. But, and dude, it's just a little thing like a fingernail.
Yeah.
You know, a flake. And then, here's another one I found in Kerrville, and I sent it off, and this traced to a place called Rabbit Mountain in New Mexico.
Wow.
So I kind of got into reading about that, and Dr. Thomas Hester, in 1970, he started this thing called the Texas Obsidian Project, and he just now wrote the paper this year. He finished the research. He's been doing it for, what is that, 54 years or something?
Yeah.
And so I sent both of those off to his, to that. And, you know, I think it cost $20 or $25, but it was worth it.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
To get the story behind it. And so, I wrote this story. Here it is right here. About this point, this was found on the beach in Rockport, but the quarry came from Yosemite, California, which is 1,500 miles away. And the type of point this is it's a Great Basin type point. It's not a Texas point,
yeah.
So we know it was made up there, but somehow
it
made its way down to to Rockport.
That opens up a whole can of beans that I've argued with a lot of people on typology. And right now, the site where that Clovis came from, there's some points that are being found there, some points that are being found in Lexington that relate, in my opinion, I think they're probably relatable to like Graham Cave or something like that, found in other states. But, you know, here they're not going to say the same thing. But people always are talking about the distribution of points across Texas, and they're like, oh, well, that point type doesn't occur there. Okay, man, like, we've got obsidian from seven states away,
yeah,
and you're telling me a point didn't travel a couple hundred miles.
There's that stuff made its way around. I know some people who are excavating I guess it's near, I don't, they probably don't want me giving away their location, but it's near Enchanted Rock.
And
they found a copper square that's the size and shape of a playing card, and it's from the Great Lakes.
Really?
So yeah, there's and it's in an archaic camp. It was in an archaic camp.
There's
a few thousand years old. So that's stuff moved around.
There's a guy I've been talking to, and we plan to have him on the show at some point. He found a piece on the coast. It's a disc. He might have talked to you. I don't know. I don't want to throw his name out or anything because I haven't talked to him about all that yet. But it's a disc, and I believe it's made out of, I think he said it's made out of copper or bronze.
No, I hadn't heard about that.
And it's a gorget. And he said the only other one recorded was found in Florida, and it almost is like a perfect, you know, match to what was found in Florida. Now, to what context it was, I don't know where it came from, all that, but he's trying to figure that all out. He found it not too long ago. When we get done, I'll show you it.
Yeah.
I'll show you some
pictures. Yeah, I'd love to see that.
He's found some awesome stuff recently, and I'm excited to get him on to talk about some stuff, maybe get y'all in contact too.
Yeah. It's frustrating sometimes the stuff that I can't put in the magazine.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, that's so cool. But
yeah.
They're like, no, we don't want that getting out.
Yeah. Yeah,
that happens a lot. But, what I was going to say about the obsidian, though, I was very fortunate to get asked by Dr. Hester to make him some maps for the report that just came out. And so when you're looking at these maps, it's like, holy cow, that there stuff was moving all across this continent and even into Mexico, in and out of Mexico, especially with this obsidian. And so with the report, I just read the report. He just sent it to me like 5 or 6 days ago. But they think probably the stuff from the Western United States, obsidian sources, came down east of the Rockies and over into what is now I-35 and came down through the Balcones corridor and then into Texas, all over into Texas. They think that it probably just changed hands. You know, there's a network of people trading small pieces of obsidian. Rather than somebody going the whole way, you know, it was changing hands and like a network.
It seems like there's been a decent amount of it found around, you know, Williamson County, Bell County. And then earlier when we were talking before the show, I was telling you about that broke celt that I found in Comanche. That same day, that dude found what? I think he found two pieces of obsidian the same day. Mm-hmm. There was just some odd stuff coming out of that camp that was being found.
And the obsidian that there's lots of camps in that report, there's lots of camps where there's multiple pieces of obsidian found from different places, like New Mexico and Idaho.
Really?
That ended up in the same camp.
That's cool.
So that stuff, like that, Dr. Hester has been spending more than a half a century studying this. And so I was really honored to be able to make him some maps.
And he's put out a report on it.
Mm-hmm.
I'd love to see that.
It's going to be in the Texas Archaeology Journal, I think, one of them. I'm not sure, but yeah, I'll send you a copy of it.
That'd be awesome.
I was really, I consider that to be a really cool achievement that I got to be a part of. You know, it's not even anything, but just having my name attached to that report is awesome.
Yeah, that's a big deal. Mm-hmm. I mean, to me, again, I think that's something that validates a lot of stuff across the state and across the country with natives and the cultures. Just showing what they were able to do and what actually did occur.
Yeah, it's crazy, man. They would, there's stuff happening all across the whole continent that'll blow your mind. And, like, Alabates Flint that's quarried up in North Texas, they find that over on the Mississippi, and they found it in Canada. They found lightning whelk shells from the Gulf of Mexico up in Canada.
Yeah.
Just moved around.
Whelk shells are another thing that I didn't know that about the Alabates, but whelk shells and obsidian are two of those things that I think are, you know, something people should consider more often than they do. That doesn't mean like every band of Indians across, you know, the state over 12,000, 16,000 years, you know, traveled tremendous distances, but there were those Indians that were traveling. I think there's different trade points. And to me too, I don't know if I've talked about this in past episodes, but when you look at Texas, to me, there's hubs in Texas that are like kind of like how you have on the Mississippi River. You have mound sites where they're almost like meccas, and there's spots in Texas that, in my opinion, there's certain areas that are kind of like central hubs where Indians were there. I mean, clearly across the state, they were there for thousands of years, but there's certain areas in Texas where they're really concentrated. The camps are condensed and the artifacts are just, they blow other areas of Texas out of the water.
Yeah. Morris Mound and on the Guadalupe River is like that.
Really?
Yeah. I think that was a place that probably people like a Mecca came to for thousands of years.
Yeah. And we talked about that with Wren, cause she's more involved in the Mississippian stuff. And, we were talking about how you don't really see that stuff in Texas, but it's still, to me, it shows that there's trade routes and things like that that did carry down into Texas. And maybe there's more to be discovered in Texas that we haven't got to see yet.
Yeah.
There's a lot of untouched things.
That's what I love about this stuff. Like, I love points and collecting them and looking at them, but I also just love the stories behind it. That's what I'm trying to do with the magazine, you know, other than just pretty pictures of rocks,
yeah,
you know, which I like that too, but trying to figure this stuff out is just awesome, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, just letting
and you don't have to, you don't have to be a scientist. You can be a forklift driver like me.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Somebody that knows nothing outside of this. But, yeah, it's interesting. And, I think the obsidian is a big factor that people need to look at. And a lot of people don't even really pay any attention to. So that's cool. That's cool that you're involved with that too, man. That's an awesome study.
Yeah, and the last time I talked to Dr. Hester, he said, "I'm done. I'm retired. I'm ending this study." You know, you can still, if you find an obsidian piece, you can still send it off, but he's not going to publish it in a report unless it's something of significance, he said. You know, a flake, like these flakes that I have, that gives you a little bit of information, but an actual full point, that gives it more of a time diagnostic quality too, that you can tell, oh, you know, it was probably made at such and such time by whatever period. So I think if people come across an actual obsidian point, he might be interested in including that in subsequent reports. But as far as flakes, I think he's beat that to death.
Yeah. So outside of that one, is there any other just super significant pieces you've got to see the past year and a half that just stand out?
Those are the main ones. This Clovis too, that Dave White found, that's just one in a million.
Yeah.
And I got to hold it in the Lampasas Arrowhead show, and I was kind of scared. Like, I don't know if I want to touch it. The Klein cache with that Zach and Evan Klein of Bandera found. That was just an awesome one.
Is that that blade cache that it was a father and a son found?
Yeah.
So I don't know the story behind it, but I seen them at, I think it was maybe Fredericksburg. Yeah, I think they had it at Fredericksburg's show.
Yeah, it's just, I can't remember how many pieces it is. And that magazine, I only have one or two copies left of that one.
Really?
That one sold out almost. But, it's, I think, eight or nine pieces, and they're ultra-thin, big blades. Like, I mean, ultra-thin. Mm. And that was one that I was afraid to touch. I'm like, nah, I can just look at it. Sometimes I like to put my hands on stuff, but that one was just too perfect and too high quality that I didn't dare.
Yeah. Yeah, I've only ever handled one piece that scared me to hold. And I mean, it's the best corner tank I've ever seen. My buddy found it. But aside from that, I haven't seen many pieces better than it, so there's not much that's really scared me to hold, but still I'll grab a piece sometimes like, but that corner tank, every time I touch it, I'm like, oh my gosh, I don't want to pick it. I want to pick it up, but I don't want to pick it up.
Yeah.
So I know what you're saying, and not even to that scale, because those things, if it's the ones I'm thinking of, they're huge. They're really big, aren't they?
Yeah.
Kind of like the ones from the Jonesboro site, but there's like five or six of them, I believe.
I think there might be a picture of it in here, but yeah, it was a, yeah, you can't really see it on this.
We'll plug Black, it in the video.
Yeah, Carlos Black, he's an authenticator. Most people in our circle know him, but he's the one who documented that and let me use his picture of it for the cover of the magazine. But that was another one that was just like, whew, God,
that's just awesome.
Yeah, and Evan, I think he was in seventh or eighth grade when he found that, and what a cool thing to be able to do with your dad.
Son found it.
They found it together, but man, that's something they'll have for the rest of their lives.
Oh yeah. Yeah. That's one of my favorite things. I mean, I've been invited to dig places and I'll tell people, you know, and it might seem kind of rude. I appreciate any invites, but if I can't take my dad, that's one deal. And like getting Christian into this, to me, a big part of digging is digging with the people that you enjoy to be with.
Sure, and yeah.
Especially my dad. I mean, not that I don't want to dig with Christian, but if I can't take my dad, I'm probably not going digging.
Yeah.
Just the memories we make, and he's the one that got me into it. I wouldn't do it if it wasn't for him. So, you know, yeah, that's awesome. I'm sure that kid will never forget that.
Yeah, and my son is six, and I'd love to do something like that.
Yeah.
You know, we go picking around and surface hunting a lot. And
yeah.
We've never really found anything all that great, but it's fun. Yeah. And he likes it. And my daughter's kind of getting into it. She found a little broke point. So, and that's one thing I want to do with the magazine too, is always keep it kid friendly, appropriate for all ages. And, you know, if any kids find stuff, I like to put that in the magazine too. 'Cause,
yeah.
And I've gone to a couple of schools and done some presentations for kids and stuff. And so bringing young people into it is important. I want to do that.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's one of my goals.
Yeah. I guess before we kind of round things out here, one thing I wanted to ask you, and we kind of talked about it earlier when we got off on the rabbit hole of burials and whatnot. What is your outlook as to, because you've been on both sides, it sounds like, of digging from an archaeological standpoint and from a hobbyist standpoint. What is your outlook on what the digging community can do? Because it is kind of, not in Texas, it's not so controversial, but there's definitely states where it's a controversial topic.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, even in Texas, like you said earlier, you know, you mentioned to somebody that you dig artifacts. Oh, well, you're a looter. No.
Yeah. But I've been told to my face, oh, that you make that potholer magazine.
Yeah.
I'm like, well, that's not how I would characterize it. Yeah. But
what do you think we can do to, you know, make our community more recognized by the public or more accepted by the public eye? And how should people that do this as a hobby or as an archaeologist, you know, what can they do to make it more acceptable?
I like the idea of just including as much information as you can. Like, if you have a frame, write down everything you can think of and stick it in the behind the foam of the frame or something. You know, yeah. Something as simple as that. You don't have to be an archaeologist. I kind of have a foot in both of those worlds, and I'm trying to, you know, make peace between private collectors and archaeologists, but I don't know how far that can go.
Yeah.
You know, but, you know, Ren was talking about, you know, in defense of the collector, that you need them.
Yeah.
You know, but also it's good to have an archaeological context and just, you know, not wipe everything out, but here's an example. GT's dig at, you know, at the Hog Eye Clovis site. That was an archaeological site for many years.
Yep.
But they archaeology got everything they needed out of it.
Yeah.
And they even had an opportunity. Do you want to keep digging? They said, no, we don't need to. So now it's a pay dig, and yeah, anybody can go there who you know can afford it and get their own artifacts, and that's great.
Yeah,
that's awesome. You can go there and you can have your own collection. Archaeology's done with it.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. It's. I think there's always going to be that animosity.
Yeah.
And it's usually, I don't want to say it's one way, but. But digging responsibly is always a good thing.
Yeah,
don't absolutely. Leave trash around. Don't leave cigarette butts and beer cans. I go to a lot of places and it's just like, come on, man, clean your trash up.
Yeah.
Stuff like that. But I don't think there's anything wrong with private collectors coming and doing that because I'm big on property rights. I like property rights.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, however to strike a balance with that, with archaeology, who knows? But then I also hear stories of paid archaeology groups who are hired by a company when they're going to do a development. You know, oh, even if there is something there, don't write it down.
Yeah.
And then it gets bulldozed or paved over. So what's worse?
Yeah, I mean, there's so many places, just driving down the road, you can drive across a place and you know that there's a camp, but it's got a bridge running through it.
Or, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and you can't touch it. And
it's the house sitting on top of the camp.
Yeah.
90% of the time.
Yeah. Subdivisions on camps.
You're going into Home Depot. Well, guess what's under there?
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
You know, so.
And I'm in agreeance with you on that. And two, I look at it from a standpoint. So, like, I started our TikTok. It used to just be my personal TikTok, and it was finds me and my dad, you know, hand digging, whatever. And a lot of times I'd have comments on there, oh, y'all are destroying all the archaeological significance. That site had no significance. It was all in a wash. So all the data is mixed and tumbled and tossed around. So there is no way to pinpoint anything in that. But then sites like the Hall Guy that have been documented, and like that's a monumental site in Texas, in my opinion. And places like that, I think it's, because from my understanding, I may be talking out my ass, but from my understanding, archaeological record only needs like 25% of the data collected at a site. Like 25% of the site, I believe. Is that correct?
I don't know.
So I think from things I've heard and read, I believe that's it. They only need about 25% to determine whatever they're determining. I'm sure there's some places they dig more extensively or less, but why at the end of the day close that off and not share that stuff with the public too?
Yeah.
And that's my biggest thing, is this stuff should be shared with the public and people should be educated on it. And like you were saying earlier, kids should be involved. And
yeah. And you know, or like you going with your dad,
yeah,
it's something that you'll always be able to remember.
Yeah.
And
I can tell you, as a kid sitting in a history class or something, I had no appreciation for Texas history and world history and United States history. But now, being involved in this stuff and viewing it from this aspect, my appreciation for all history is totally different.
Yeah, and same.
I think there's a way that, even tying it into like educational purposes, you could make this more enjoyable for kids and make them want to be more involved with this country's history from start to the finish.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just like playing in the sandbox.
Yeah.
When you're a kid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Rolling kids.
I mean, you throw stuff in there just to bury it and try to find it again.
Yeah.
I mean, it's no different than that.
Yeah, my kid goes in his sandbox and he gets down to the vinyl bottom. I found a dinosaur bone.
He's digging all the way.
It must be big.
Hope you don't have a cat.
Digging all the way to the bottom. That's good. But, man, I think this has been a great episode. I think we covered a lot of stuff, and we appreciate you being here. And
thank you. I could talk all day long. I appreciate you guys having me on. It's
absolutely fun. We'll definitely have you on again, too. I mean, everybody we've had on here is people, you know, we appreciate, want to have on in the future. And that's another thing with this, is just like your magazine, I mean, it's been going, what, 30 years now? Mm-hmm. Every day is a new story. And
There's so much that I can't even fit in it.
Yeah.
It's, I can't keep up with it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sure. You guys feel the same way.
Yeah.
It's your show, right?
It's crazy.
There's probably no shortage of topics that you can think of, right?
No, it's
just not enough time to cover.
Just not enough time to get it all edited and done.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, well, you guys are doing a great job with this show, and I love driving around listening to it. So
well, thank you.
It's, yeah,
good job. Do you want to shout out how to get on the subscription again?
Sure, yeah. It's Texas Cache Magazine, and it's C-A-C-H-E, like a geocache. The French might pronounce it cachet, but I went so far as to look it up in the dictionary, and it's cache.
Is it?
Yeah.
I'm glad, because, I'll watch videos or hear people talking. They're like, oh, you found a cachet. I'm like, I'm pretty sure it's cache.
But. Yeah, it is. well, at least according to the dictionary.
Yeah. Hey, I'm going with that. That's how I say it.
But, it's TexasCacheMagazine.com. It's got all the info there, and there's a big subscribe button up at the top. And like I said, there's a Texas Cache Voice Facebook page that Patty does, and I'm not really on Facebook. I have an Instagram, so if you hit me up on Instagram, I'll see it.
Yeah.
But Patty does the Facebook thing, and you know, one of these days I might get around to getting on socials, but right now I like making a magazine that you can hold in your hand. It comes in your mailbox and you hold it in your hand.
Yeah, and talking about coming to your mailbox, it gets here quick too. When he first sent us the initial package of magazines and the poster and all that, he told me he was sending it, and I think it got here in like maybe overnight almost.
Is that right?
It was fast. And then,
well, good. My mailing service works.
Yeah. Yeah. The issue you just sent out, it took it a little longer.
Yeah, it's weird. Sometimes, like, you never know. Some people will get it the next day, and other people might take 3 weeks.
Yeah.
And it's all in, mostly all in Texas, but
yeah.
I don't know what stuff gets, you know,
well, hope
it's lost in the mail sometimes, or temporarily maybe.
Maybe we can get you some more subscribers out of state and stuff. Surprisingly, as you know, being as new and stuff as we are, we have listeners pretty well all across the country. I want to make a map eventually of where we have listeners, and we've got some people even overseas in Germany and stuff.
Oh, cool.
I don't know who they are because I can't see it in our analytics, but it is cool to pull it up and see where people are listening from.
Wow, that's awesome.
Just like you said with your subscribers. So, and, you know, we appreciate everybody that listens to this. Again, if y'all are listening, if you've watched this, go check out Texas Cash. Give them a subscription. Tons of information in these magazines he's putting out every 4 months.
Yeah, and the
three
other
months,
thing is
3 months.
I've got 30 years worth of back issues.
Yeah.
And so there's always, if I'm writing something, I'll flip through and be like, oh yeah, I can include that in a quarter page, and you know, this appeared 20 years ago or whatever. And
that's cool.
So that's, there's a 3,000 pages of archives.
Wow.
That I can pick through. So there, and obviously I'm standing on the shoulders figuratively of Pat Even and Bob McWilliams, who started it. And
yes, sir.
And I love keeping it going, and man, thank you for having me in,
yes,
to
sir.
Talk about it.
Yes, sir.
So
thank
cool.
you for being here.
Yes, sir. We appreciate it. And make sure y'all keep living your hobbies, but we'll see y'all later.
Later, guys.